One day he would notice, and there would be awkward questions to answer. But that day wouldn't be today, because sometime in the past few minutes, Mark had slipped soundlessly out of the library. He was gone. Mark associated different rooms in the Institute with different feelings, most of them new since his return. The Rowand Library made him tense. The entryway, where he faced down Sebastian Morgenstern so many years ago, made his skin prickle, his blood heat. In his own room, he felt lonely. In the twins' rooms, and Drew's or Tavi's, he could lose himself in being their older brother. In Emma's room, he felt safe. Christina's room was barred to him. In Julian's room, he felt guilty. And in the training room, he felt like a shadow hunter. He had made unconsciously for the training room the moment he'd left the library. It was still too much for Mark, the way that shadow hunters hid their emotions. How could they bear a world where Helen was exiled? He could hardly bear it. He yearned for his sister every day. And yet, they all would have looked at him in surprise if he had cried out in grief or fallen to his knees. Jules, he knew, didn't want the Centaurians there. But his expression had hardly changed. Fairies could riddle and cheat and scheme, but they did not hide their honest pain. It was enough to send him to the weapons rack, his hands feeling for whatever would let him lose himself in practice. Diana had owned a weapons shop in Idris once, and there was always an impeccable array of beautiful weapons laid out for them to train with. Greek Makara, with their single cutting edges. There were Viking spada, two-handed claymores and zweihander, and Japanese wooden boken, used only for training. He thought of the weapons of Faerie, the sword he had carried in the wild hunt. The Fae used nothing made of iron, for weapons and tools of iron made them sick. The sword he had borne in the hunt was made of horn, and it had been light in his hand. Light like the elf bolts he had shot from his bow. Light like the wind under the feet of his horse, like the air around him when he rode. He lifted a claymore from the rack and turned it experimentally in his hand. He could feel that it was made of steel, not quite iron, but an iron alloy, though he didn't have the reaction to iron that full-blooded fairies did. It did feel heavy in his hand, but so much had been feeling heavy since he had returned home. The weight of expectation was heavy. The weight of how much he loved his family was heavy. Even the weight of what he was involved in with Emma was heavy. He trusted Emma. He didn't question she was doing the right thing. If she believed it, he believed in her. But lies didn't come to him easily, and he hated lying to his family, most of all. Mark? It was Clary, followed by Jace. The meeting in the library must be over. They had both changed into gear. Clary's red hair was very bright, like a splash of blood against her dark clothes. "I'm here," Mark said, placing the sword he'd been holding back in the rack. The full moon was high, and white light filtered through the windows. The moon traced a path like a road across the sea from where it kissed the horizon to the edge of the beach. Jace hadn't said anything yet. He was watching Mark with hooded golden eyes like a hawk's. Mark couldn't help but remember Clary and Jace as they had been when he'd met them just after the hunt had taken him. He'd been hiding in the tunnels near the Seely Court when they'd come walking toward him, and his heart had ached and broken to see them. Shadow hunters, striding through the dangers of fairy, heads held high. They were not lost. They were not running. They were not afraid. He wondered if he would ever have that pride again. The lack of fear. Even as Jace had pressed a witchlight into his hand, even as he had said, "Show them what a shadow hunter is made of. Show them that you aren't afraid." Mark had been sick with fear. Not for himself, for his family. How would they fare in a world at war without him to protect them? Surprisingly well had been the answer. They hadn't needed him after all. They'd had Jules. Jace seated himself on a windowsill. He was bigger than he had been the first time Mark had met him, of course. Taller, broader-shouldered, though still graceful. Rumor had it that even the Seely Queen had been impressed by his looks and manner, and fairy gentry were rarely impressed by humans, even shadow hunters. Though sometimes they were. Mark supposed his own existence was proof of that. His mother, the Lady Nerissa of the Seely Court, had loved his shadow hunter father. "Julian doesn't want the Centaurians here," said Jace. "Does he?" Mark looked at them both with suspicion.
"I wouldn't know."
"Mark won't tell us his brother's secrets, Jace," said Clary. "Would you tell Alex?" The window behind Jace rose high and clear, so clear Mark sometimes imagined he could fly out of it.
"Maybe if it was for his own good," Jace said.
Clary made an inelegant, doubtful noise.
"Mark," she said, "we need your help. We have some questions about Fairy and the courts, their actual physical layout, and there don't seem to be any answers. Not from the Spiral Labyrinth, not from the Scholomance."
"And honestly," Jace said, "we don't want to look too much like we're investigating, because the mission is secret."
"Your mission is to Fairy?" Mark guessed.
They both nodded. Mark was astonished. Shadowhunters had never been comfortable in the actual lands of Fairy, and since the Cold Peace they'd avoided them like poison.
"Why?"
He turned quickly from the claymore.
"Is this some kind of revenge mission? Because Irloth and some of the others cooperated with Malcolm, or because of what happened to Emma?"
Emma still sometimes needed help with the last of her bandages. Every time Mark looked at the red lines crossing her skin, he felt guilt and sickness. They were like a web of bloody threads that kept him bound to the deception they were both perpetrating. Clary's eyes were kind.
"We're not planning to hurt anyone," she said. "There's no revenge going on here. This is strictly about information."
"You think I'm worried about Kieran?"
realized Mark. The name lodged in his throat like a piece of snapped-off bone. He had loved Kieran, and Kieran had betrayed him and gone back to the hunt. And whenever Mark thought about him, it felt as if he were bleeding from someplace inside.
"I am not," he said, "worried about Kieran."
"Then you wouldn't mind if we talked to him?" said Jace.
"I wouldn't be worried about him," said Mark.
"I might be worried about you."
Clary laughed softly.
"Thank you, Mark."
"He's the son of the Unseelie Court's king," said Mark. "The king has 50 sons. All of them vie for the throne. The king is tired of them. He owed Gwyn a favor, so he gave him Kieran in repayment, like a gift of a sword or a dog."
"As I understand it," said Jace, "Kieran came to you and offered to help you against the wishes of the Fae. He put himself in grave danger to assist you." Mark supposed he shouldn't be surprised that Jace knew that. Emma often confided in Clary.
"He owed me. It was thanks to him that those I love were badly hurt."
"Still," said Jace, "there is some chance he might be amenable to our questions, especially if we could tell him they were endorsed by you."
Mark said nothing. Clary kissed Jace on the cheek and murmured something in his ear before she headed out of the room. Jace watched her go, his expression momentarily soft. Mark felt a sharp stab of envy. He wondered if he would ever be like that with someone, the way they seemed a match. Clary's kind playfulness and Jace's sarcasm and strength. He wondered if he had ever matched with Kieran. If he would have matched with Christina, had things been different.
"What is it you mean to ask, Kieran?" he said.
"Some questions about the queen and about the king," said Jace.
Noting Mark's impatient movement, he said, "I'll tell you a little. And remember, I should be telling you nothing. McClave would have my head for this." He sighed. "Sebastian Morgenstern left a weapon with one of the courts of Fairy," he said. "A weapon that could destroy us all. Destroy all Niflheim."
"What does the weapon do?" Mark asked.
"I don't know. That's part of what we need to find out. But we know it's deadly."
Mark nodded.
I think Kieran will help you, he said. And I can give you a list of names of those in Faerie to look for who might be friendly to your cause, because it will not be a popular one. I do not think you know how much they hate you. If they have a weapon, I hope you find it, because they will not hesitate to use it, and they will have no mercy on you. Jace looked up through golden lashes that were very much like Kit's. His gaze was watchful and still.
Mercy on us, he said. You're one of us.
That seems to depend on who you ask, Mark said. Do you have a pen and paper? I'll start with the names. It had been too long since Uncle Arthur had left the attic room where he slept, ate, and at his work. Julian wrinkled his nose as he and Diana climbed the narrow stairs. The air was staler than usual, rancid with old food and sweat. The shadows were thick. Arthur was a shadow himself, hunched over his desk, a witchlight burning in a dish on the windowsill above. He didn't react to Julian and Diana's presence.
Arthur,
Diana said, we need to speak with you. Arthur turned slowly in his chair. Julian felt his gaze skate over Diana and then over himself.
Miss Rayburn, he said finally, what can I do for you?
Diana had accompanied Julian on trips to the attic before, but rarely. Now that the truth of their situation was known by Mark and Emma, Julian had been able to acknowledge to Diana what they had always both known but never spoken about. For years, since he was 12 years old, Julian had borne alone the knowledge that his Uncle Arthur was mad. His mind shattered during his imprisonment in the Seely Court. He had periods of lucidity, helped by the medicine Malcolm Fade had provided, but they never lasted long. If the Clave knew the truth, they would have ripped Arthur away from his position as Institute head in moments. It was quite likely he would end up locked up in the Basilius, forbidden from leaving or having visitors. In his absence, with no Blackthorn adult to run the Institute, the children would be split up, sent to the Academy in Idris, scattered around the world. Julian's determination to never let that happen had led to 5 years of secret-keeping, 5 years of hiding Arthur from the world, and the world from Arthur. Sometimes he wondered if he was doing the right thing for his uncle, but did it matter? Either way, he would protect his brothers and sisters. He would sacrifice Arthur for them if he had to, and if the moral consequences woke him up in the middle of the night, sometimes panicked and gasping, then he'd live with that. He remembered Kieran's sharp, fairy eyes on him.
You have a ruthless heart. Maybe it was true. Right now Julian's heart felt dead in his chest, a swollen, beatless lump. Everything seemed to be happening at a slight distance. He even felt as if he were moving slowly through the world, as if he were pushing his way through water. Still, it was a relief to have Diana with him. Arthur often mistook Julian for his dead father or grandfather, but Diana was no part of his past, and he seemed to have no choice but to recognize her.
The medication that Malcolm made for you, said Diana. Did he ever speak to you about it? What was in it?
Arthur shook his head slightly.
The boy doesn't know.
Julian knew that meant him.
No,
he said. Malcolm never spoke of it to me. Arthur frowned.
Are there dregs, leftovers, that could be analyzed?
I used every drop I could find 2 weeks ago. Julian had drugged his uncle with a powerful cocktail of Malcolm's medicine the last time Jace, Clary, and the Inquisitor had been at the Institute. He hadn't dared take the chance that Arthur would be anything but steady on his feet and as clear-headed as possible. Julian was fairly sure Jace and Clary would cover up Arthur's condition if they knew it, but it was an unfair burden to ask them to bear, and besides, he didn't trust the Inquisitor, Robert Lightwood. He hadn't trusted him since the time 5 years ago when Robert had forced him to endure a brutal trial by mortal sword, because he hadn't believed Julian wouldn't lie.
You haven't kept any of it, Arthur? Diana asked. Hidden some away?
Arthur shook his head again.
In the dim witch light, he looked old, much older than he was. His hair salted with gray, his eyes washed out like the ocean in the early morning. His body under his straggling gray robe was skinny, the point of his shoulder bone visible through the material.
"I didn't know Malcolm would turn out to be what he was," he said. "A murderer, a killer, a traitor. Besides, I depended on the boy." He cleared his throat. "Julian."
"I didn't know about Malcolm either," Julian said. "The thing is, we're going to have guests. Centaurians."
"Kentarks," murmured Arthur, opening one of his desk drawers as if he meant to search for something inside. "That is what they were called in the Byzantine army. But a centurion was always the pillar of the army. He commanded 100 men. A centurion could mete out punishment to a Roman citizen that the law usually protected them from. Centurions supersede the law."
Julian wasn't sure how much the original Roman centurions and the centurions of the Scholomance had in common, but he suspected he got his uncle's point anyway. "Right, so that means we're going to have to be especially careful with how you're going to have to be around them, how you're going to have to act." Arthur put his fingers to his temples.
"I'm just so tired," he murmured. "Can we not... if we could ask Malcolm for a bit more medicine."
"Malcolm's dead," Julian said. His uncle had been told, but it didn't seem to have quite sunk in. And it was exactly the sort of mistake he couldn't make around strangers. "There are mundane drugs," said Diana after a moment's hesitation.
"But the clave," Julian said.
"The punishment for seeking out mundane medical treatment is..." "I know what it is," Diana said, surprisingly sharply, "but we're desperate. But we have no idea about what dosage or what pills. We have no idea how mundanes treat sicknesses like this."
"I am not ill," Arthur slammed the drawer of the desk shut. "The fairies shattered my mind. I felt it break. No mundane could understand or treat such a thing."
Diana exchanged a worried look with Julian. "Well, there are several paths we could go down. We'll leave you alone, Arthur, and discuss them. We know how important your work is."
"Yes,"
Julian's uncle murmured.
"My work."
And he bent again over his papers, Diana and Julian instantly forgotten. As Julian followed Diana out of the room, he couldn't help but wonder what solace it was that his uncle found in old stories of gods and heroes, of an earlier time of the world, one where plugging your ears and refusing to listen to the sound of the music of sirens could keep you from madness. At the foot of the stairs, Diana turned to Julian and spoke softly.
"You'll have to go to the shadow market tonight."
"What?" Julian was thrown. The shadow market was off-limits to Nephilim, unless they were on a mission, and always off-limits to underage shadow hunters.
"With you?"
Diana shook her head.
"I can't go there."
Julian didn't ask. It was an unspoken fact between them that Diana had secrets and that Julian could not press her about them. "But there'll be warlocks," she said. "Ones we don't know. Ones who'll keep silent for a price. Ones who won't know your face. And fairies. This is a fairy-caused madness, after all, not a natural state. Perhaps they would know how to reverse it." She was silent for a moment, thinking.
"Bring Kit with you," she said.
"He knows the shadow market better than anyone else we could ask, and downworlders there trust him."
"He's just a kid," Julian objected.
"And he hasn't been out of the Institute since his father died.
Was killed, actually. Ripped to pieces in front of his eyes.
It could be hard on him." "He'll have to get used to things being hard on him," said Diana, her expression flinty. "He's a shadow hunter now."
Chapter 3. Where Dwell the Ghouls. Vicious traffic meant it took Julian and Kit an hour to get from Malibu to Old Pasadena. By the time they found parking, Julian had a pounding headache, not helped by the fact that Kit had barely said a word to him since they'd left the Institute. Even so long after sunset, the sky in the west was touched with feather strokes of crimson and black. The wind was blowing from the east, which meant that even in the middle of the city you could breathe in desert, sand and grit, cactus and coyotes, the burning scent of sage. Kit leaped out of the car the minute Julian turned the engine off, as if he couldn't stand spending another minute next to him. When they'd passed the freeway exit that went to the Rook's old house, Kit had asked if he could swing by to pick up some of his clothes. Julian had said no, it wasn't safe, especially at night. Kit had looked at him as if Julian had driven a knife into his back. Julian was used to pleading and sulks and protestations that someone hated you. He had four younger siblings. But there was a special artistry to Kit's glaring. He really meant it. Now, as Julian locked the car behind them, Kit made a snorting sound. "You look like a shadow hunter." Julian glanced down at himself. Jeans, boots, a vintage blazer that had been a gift from Emma. Since glamour runes weren't much use at the market, he'd had to fall back on pulling down his sleeve to cover his voyance rune and flipping up his collar to conceal the very edges of marks that would otherwise have peeked out from his shirt. "What?" he said. "You can't see any marks." "You don't need to," said Kit in a bored voice. "You look like a cop. All of you always look like cops." Julian's headache intensified. "And your suggestion?" "Let me go in alone," Kit said. "They know me. They trust me. They'll answer my questions and sell me whatever I want." He held out a hand. "I'll need some money, of course." Julian looked at him in disbelief. "You didn't really think that would work, did you?" Kit shrugged and retracted his hand. "It could have worked." Julian started walking toward the alley that led to the entrance to the shadow market. He'd only been there once years ago, but he remembered it well. Shadow markets had sprung up in the aftermath of the Cold Peace, a way for downworlders to do business away from the spotlight of the new laws. "So, let me guess. Your plan was to take some money from me, pretend you were going to the shadow market, and hop a bus out of town?" "Actually, my plan was to take some money from you, pretend I was going to the shadow market, and hop on a Metrolink," said Kit. "They have trains that leave the city now. Major development, I know. You should try to keep track of these things." Julian wondered briefly what Jace would do if he strangled Kit. He considered voicing the thought aloud, but they'd reached the end of the alley, where a slight shimmer in the air was visible. He grabbed Kit by the arm, propelling them both through it at the same time. They emerged on the other side into the heart of the market. Light flared all around them, blotting out the stars overhead. Even the moon seemed a pale shell. Julian was still gripping Kit's arm, but Kit was making no move to run. He was looking around with a wistfulness that made him look young. Sometimes it was hard for Julian to remember that Kit was the same age as Ty. His blue eyes, clear and sky-colored, without the green tinge that characterized the Blackthorn's eyes, moved around the market, taking it in. Rows of booths were lit with torches whose fires blazed gold, blue, and poison green. Trellises of flowers, richer and sweeter smelling than white oleander or jacaranda blossoms, cascaded down the sides of stalls. Beautiful fairy girls and boys danced to the music of reeds and pipes. Everywhere were voices clamoring for them to come, buy. Weapons were on display, and jewelry and vials of potions and powders. "This way," said Kit, pulling his arm out of Julian's grip. Julian followed. He could feel eyes on them, wondered if it was because Kit had been right. He looked like a cop, or the supernatural version anyway. He was a shadow hunter, had always been a shadow hunter. You couldn't shed your nature. They had reached one of the market's edges, where the light was dimmer, and it was possible to see the white lines painted on the asphalt under them that revealed this place's daytime job as a parking lot. Kit moved toward the closest booth, where a fairy woman sat in front of a sign that advertised fortune-telling and love potions. She looked up with a beaming smile as he approached. "Kit!" she exclaimed.
She wore a scrap of a white dress that set off her pale blue skin, and her pointed ears poked through lavender hair. Thin chains of gold and silver dangled around her neck and dripped from her wrists. She glared at Julian. "What is he doing here?"
"The Niflheim is all right, Hyacinth," Kit said. "I'll vouch for him. He just wants to buy something."
"Doesn't everyone?" she murmured. She cast Julian a sly look. "You're a pretty one," she said. "Your eyes are almost the same color as me."
Julian moved closer to the booth. It was at times like this he wished he was any good at flirting. He wasn't. He had never in his life felt a flicker of desire for any girl who wasn't Emma, so it was something he'd never learned to do.
"I'm seeking a potion to cure madness in a shadow hunter," he said. "Or at least stop the symptoms for a while."
"What kind of madness?"
"He was tormented in the courts," Julian said bluntly. "His mind was broken by the hallucinations and potions they forced on him."
"A shadow hunter with fairy-caused madness? Oh, my," she said, and there was skepticism in her tone.
Julian began to explain about Uncle Arthur, without using his name, his situation and his condition. The fact that his lucid periods came and went. The fact that sometimes his moods made him bleak and cruel. That he recognized his family only part of the time. He described the potion Malcolm had made for Arthur back when they trusted Malcolm and thought he was their friend. Not that he mentioned Malcolm by name. The fairy woman shook her head when he was done.
"You should ask a warlock," she said.
"They will deal with shadow hunters. I will not. I have no desire to run afoul of the courts or the clave."
"No one needs to know about it," said Julian. "I'll pay you well."
"Child," there was an edge of pity in her voice, "you think you can keep secrets from all of Downworld? You think the market hasn't been buzzing with the news of the fall of the Guardian and the death of Johnny Rook? The fact that we no longer have a high warlock? The disappearance of Anselm Nightshade, though he was a terrible man?" She shook her head.
"You should never have come here," she said. "It's not safe for either of you."
Kit looked bewildered.
"You mean him," he said, indicating Julian with a tilt of his head. "It's not safe for him."
"Not for you either, baby boy," said a gravelly voice behind them.
They both turned. A short man stood in front of them. He was pale, with a flat, sickly cast to his skin. He wore a three-piece gray wool suit, which must have been boiling in the warm weather. His hair and beard were dark and neatly clipped.
"Barnabas," said Kit, blinking.
Julian noticed Hyacinth shrinking slightly in her booth. A small crowd had gathered behind Barnabas. The short man stepped forward.
"Barnabas Hale," he said, holding out a hand.
The moment his fingers closed around Julian's, Julian felt his muscles tighten. Only Ty's affinity for lizards and snakes, and the fact that Julian had had to carry them out of the Institute and dump them back in the grass more than once, kept him from pulling his hand away. Barnabas's skin wasn't pale. It was a mesh of overlapping whitish scales. His eyes were yellow, and they looked with amusement on Julian, as if expecting him to jerk his hand away. The scales against Julian's skin were like smooth, cold pebbles. They weren't slimy, but they felt as if they ought to be. Julian held the grip for several long moments before lowering his arm.
"You're a warlock," he said.
"Never claimed to be anything different," said Barnabas. "And you're a shadow hunter."
Julian sighed and pulled his sleeve back into place.
"I suppose there wasn't much point in trying to disguise it."
"None at all," said Barnabas. "Most of us can recognize a Niflheim on sight. And besides, young Mr. Rook has been the talk of the town."
He turned his slit-pupiled eyes on Kit. "Sorry to hear about your father."
Kit acknowledged this with a slight nod.
"Barnabas owns the shadow market. At least he owns the land the market's on, and he collects the rent for the stalls."
"That's true," said Barnabas. "So you understand I'm serious when I ask you both to leave."
We're not causing any trouble, said Julian. We came here to do business.
Nephilim don't do business at shadow markets, said Barnabas.
I think you'll find they do, said Julian. A friend of mine bought some arrows here not long ago. They turned out to be poisoned. Any ideas about that?
Barnabas jabbed a squat finger at him.
That's what I mean, he said. You can't turn it off. Even if you want to, this thinking, you get to ask the questions and make the rules.
They do make the rules, said Kit.
Kit, said Julian out of the side of his mouth, not helping.
A friend of mine disappeared the other day, said Barnabas. Malcolm Fade. Any ideas about that?
There was a low buzz in the crowd behind him. Julian opened and closed his hands at his sides. If he'd been here alone, he wouldn't have been worried. He could have gotten himself out of the crowd easily enough and back to the car. But with Kit to protect, it would be harder.
See? Barnabas demanded. For every secret you think you know, we know another. I know what happened to Malcolm.
Do you know what he did? Julian asked, carefully controlling his voice. Malcolm had been a murderer, a mass murderer. He'd killed downworlders as well as mundanes. Surely the Blackthorns couldn't be blamed for his death. Do you know why it happened?
I see. Only another downworlder, dead at the hands of Nephilim. And Anselm Nightshade, too. Imprisoned for a bit of simple magic. What next?
He spat on the ground at his feet. There might have been a time I tolerated shadow hunters in the market, was willing to take their money, but that time is over. The warlock's gaze skittered to Kit.
Go, he said, and take your Nephilim friend with you.
He's not my friend, said Kit, and I'm not like them. I'm like you.
Barnabas was shaking his head. Hyacinth watched, her blue hands steepled under her chin, her eyes wide.
A dark time is coming for shadow hunters, said Barnabas. A terrible time. Their power will be crushed, their might thrown down in the dirt, and their blood will run like water through the riverbeds of the world.
That's enough, said Julian sharply. Stop trying to frighten him.
You will pay for the cold peace, said the warlock. The darkness is coming, and you will be well advised, Christopher Herondale, to stay far away from institutes and shadow hunters. Hide, as your father did, and his father before him. Only then can you be safe.
How do you know who I am? Kit demanded. How do you know my real name?
It was the first time Julian heard him admit that Herondale was his real name.
Everyone knows, said Barnabas. It's all the market has been buzzing about for days. Didn't you see everyone staring at you when you came in?
So they hadn't been looking at Julian. Or at least not just at Julian. It wasn't much comfort, though, Jules thought. Not when Kit had that expression on his face.
I thought I could come back here, Kit said. Take over my father's stall. Work in the market.
A forked tongue flickered out between Barnabas's lips.
Born a shadow hunter, always a shadow hunter, he said. You cannot wash the taint from your blood. I'm telling you, for the last time, boy, leave the market, and don't come back.
Kit backed up, looking around him, seeing, as if for the first time, the faces turned toward him, most blank and unfriendly, many avidly curious.
Kit, Julian began, reaching out a hand.
But Kit had bolted. It took Julian only a few moments to catch up with Kit. The boy hadn't really been trying to run, he'd just been pushing blindly through the crowds with no destination. He'd fetched up in front of a massive stall that seemed to be in the middle of being torn apart. It was just a bare latticework of boards now. It looked as if someone had ripped it to pieces with her hands. Jagged bits of wood lay scattered around the blacktop. A sign dangled crookedly from the top of the stall, printed with the words, "Part supernatural? You're not alone. The followers of the Guardian want you to sign up for the lottery of favor. Let luck into your life." "The Guardian," Kit said. "That was Malcolm Fade?" Julian nodded. "He was the one who got my father involved in all that stuff with the followers in the Midnight Theater," said Kit, his tone almost thoughtful. "It's Malcolm's fault he died." Julian didn't say anything. Johnny Rook hadn't been much of a prize, but he was Kit's father. He only got one father, and Kit wasn't wrong. Kit moved then, slamming his fist as hard as he could into the sign. It clattered to the ground. In the moment before Kit pulled his hand back, wincing, Julian saw a flash of the Shadow Hunter in him. If the warlock wasn't already dead, Julian believed sincerely that Kit would have killed Malcolm. A small crowd had followed from Hyacinth's stall, staring. Julian put a hand on Kit's back, and Kit didn't move to shake it off. "Let's go," Julian said. Emma showered carefully. The downside of having your hair long when you were a shadow hunter was never knowing after a fight if there was ichor in it. Once the back of her neck had been green for a week. When she came out into her bedroom, wearing sweatpants and a tank top and rubbing her hair dry with a green towel, she found Mark curled up at the foot of her bed, reading a copy of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. He was wearing a pair of cotton pajama bottoms that Emma had bought for $3 from a vendor on the side of the PCH. He was partial to them, as being oddly close in their loose, light material to the sort of trousers he'd worn in Fairy. If it bothered him that they also had a pattern of green shamrocks embroidered with the words "Get Lucky" on them, he didn't show it. He sat up when Emma came in, scrubbing his hands through his hair and smiled at her. Mark had a smile that could break your heart. It seemed to take up his whole face and brighten his eyes, firing the blue and gold from inside. "A strange evening, forsooth," he said. "Don't you forsooth me," she flopped down on the bed next to him. He wouldn't sleep on the bed, but he didn't seem to mind using the mattress as a sort of giant sofa. He set his book down and leaned back against the footboard. "You know my rules about forsoothing in my room. Also the use of the words howbeit, well-a-day, and alack." "What about Zunes?" "The punishment for Zunes is severe," she told him. "You'll have to run naked into the ocean in front of the Centaurians." Mark looked puzzled. "And then?" She sighed. "Sorry, I forgot. Most of us mind being naked in front of strangers, take my word for it." "Really? You've never swum naked in the ocean?" "That's kind of a different question, but no, I never have." She leaned back beside him. "We should one day," he said. "All of us." "I can't imagine Perfect Diego ripping off all his clothes and leaping into the water in front of us. Maybe just in front of Christina. Maybe." Mark clambered off the bed and onto the pile of blankets she put on the floor for him. "I doubt it. I bet he swims with all his clothes on. Otherwise he'd have to take off his Centaurian pin." She laughed, and he gave her an answering smile, though he looked tired. She sympathized. It wasn't the normal activities of shadow hunting that were tiring her out. It was the pretense. Perhaps it made sense that she and Mark could only unwind at night around each other, since there was no one then to pretend for. They were the only times she had relaxed since the day Jem had told her about the Parabatai curse. How Parabatai, who fell in love, would go insane and destroy themselves and everyone they loved. She'd known immediately. She couldn't let that happen. Not to Julian. Not to his family, who she loved too. She couldn't have stopped herself loving Julian. It was impossible. So she had to make Julian not love her. Julian had given her the key himself, only days before. Words whispered against her skin in a rare moment of vulnerability. He was jealous of Mark. Jealous that Mark could talk to her, flirt with her,
easily, while Julian always had to hide what he felt.
Mark was leaning against the footboard beside her now, his eyes half closed, crescents of color under his lids, his eyelashes a shade darker than his hair. She remembered asking him to come to her room.
"I need you to pretend with me that we're dating, that we're falling in love."
He'd held out his hand to her, and she'd seen the storm in his eyes, the fierceness that reminded her that fairy was more than green grass and revels, that it was callous, wild cruelty, tears and blood, lightning that slashed the night sky like a knife.
"Why lie?" he'd asked. She'd thought for a moment he'd been asking her, "Why do you want to tell this lie?" But he hadn't been. He'd been asking, "Why lie when we can make it the truth, this thing between us?"
She'd stood before him, aching all the way down to the floor of her soul, in all the places where she'd ripped Julian away from her, as if she'd torn off a limb. They said that men joined the wild hunt sometimes, when they had sustained a great loss, preferring to howl out their grief to the skies than to suffer in silence in their ordinary gray lives. She remembered soaring through the sky with Mark, his arms around her waist. She had let the wind take her screams of excitement, thrilling to the freedom of the sky, where there was no pain, no worry, only forgetfulness. And here was Mark, beautiful in the way that the night sky was beautiful, offering her that same freedom with an outstretched hand.
"What if I could love, Mark?" she thought. "What if I could make this lie true?"
Then it would be no lie. If she could love Mark, it would end all the danger. Julian would be safe. She had nodded, reached her hand out to Mark's. She let herself remember that night in her room, the look in his eyes when he'd asked her, "Why lie?" She remembered his warm clasp, his fingers circling her wrist. How they had nearly stumbled in their haste to get nearer to each other, colliding almost awkwardly, as if they'd been dancing and had missed a step. She had clasped Mark by the shoulders and stretched up to kiss him. He was wiry from the hunt, not as muscled as Julian, the bones of his clavicle and shoulders sharp under her hands, but his skin was smooth where she pushed her hands down the neck of his shirt, stroking the top of his spine, and his mouth was warm on hers. He tasted bittersweet and felt hot, as if he had a fever. She instinctively moved closer to him. She hadn't realized she was shivering, but she was. His mouth opened over hers. He explored her lips with his, sending slow waves of heat through her body. He kissed the corner of her mouth, brushed his lips against her jaw, her cheek. He drew back. "Em?" he said, looking puzzled. "You taste of salt." She drew her right hand back from its clasp around his neck, touched her face. It was wet. She'd been crying. He frowned.
"I don't understand. You want the world to believe we are a couple, and yet you are weeping as if I have hurt you. Have I hurt you? Julian will never forgive me."
The mention of Julian's name almost undid her. She sank down on the foot of her bed, gripping her knees.
"Julian has so much to cope with," she said. "I can't have him worrying about me, about my relationship with Cameron."
Silently, she apologized to Cameron Ashdown, who really hadn't done anything wrong.
"It's not a good relationship," she said. "Not healthy. But every time it ends, I fall back into it again. I need to break that pattern. And I need Julian not to be anxious about it. There's already too much. The Clave would be investigating the fallout from Malcolm's death, our involvement with the court."
"Hush," he said, sitting down next to her. "I understand." He reached up and pulled the blanket down from her bed. Emma watched him in surprise as he wrapped it around the two of them, tucking it around both their shoulders.
She thought of the wild hunt then, the way he must have been with Kieran, huddled in shelters, wrapping themselves in their cloaks to block the cold. He traced the line of her cheekbone with his fingers. It was a friendly gesture. The heat that had been in their kiss was gone, and Emma was glad. It had seemed wrong to feel that, even the shadow of it, with anyone but Julian.
"Those who are not fairies find comfort in lies," he said.
"I cannot judge that. I will do this with you, Emma. I will not abandon you." She leaned against his shoulder. Relief made her feel light.
"You must tell Christina, though," he added. "She is your best friend. You cannot hide so much from her."
Emma nodded. She had always planned to tell Christina. Christina was the only one who knew about her feelings for Julian, and she would never for a moment believe that Emma had suddenly fallen in love with Mark instead. She would have to be told for practicality's sake, and Emma was glad.
"I can trust her completely," she said. "Now, tell me about the wild hunt."
He began to speak, weaving a story of a life lived in the clouds and in the deserted and lost places of the world, hollow cities at the bottom of copper canyons, the shell of Orodora Sir Glen, where he and Kieran had slept in a half-burned hayloft, sand and the smell of the ocean in Cyprus, in an empty resort town where trees grew through the floors of abandoned grand hotels. Slowly, Emma drifted off to sleep, with Mark holding her and whispering stories. Somewhat to her surprise, he'd come back the next night. It would help make their relationship seem convincing, he'd said. But she'd seen in his eyes that he'd liked the company, just as she had. And so they'd spent every night since then together, sprawled in the covers, piled on the floor, trading stories. Emma spoke of the dark war, of how she felt lost sometimes now that she was no longer searching for the person who'd killed her parents. And Mark talked about his brothers and sisters, about how he and Ty had argued and he worried he'd made his younger brother feel as if he wasn't there to be relied on, as if he might leave at any minute.
"Just tell him you might leave, but you'll always come back to him," Emma said.
"Tell him you're sorry if you ever made him feel any different." He only nodded. He never told her if he'd taken her advice, but she'd taken his and told Christina everything. It had been a huge relief, and she'd cried in Christina's arms for several hours. She'd even gotten Julian's permission to tell Christina an abbreviated version of the situation with Arthur, enough to make it clear how badly Julian was needed here at the Institute with his family. She'd asked Julian's permission to share that information, an extremely awkward conversation, but he'd almost seemed relieved that someone else would know. She'd wanted to ask him if he'd tell the rest of the family the truth about Arthur soon, but she couldn't. Walls had gone up around Julian that seemed as impenetrable as the thorns around Sleeping Beauty's castle. She wondered if Mark had noticed, if any of the others had noticed, or if only she could see it. She turned to look at Mark now. He was asleep on the floor, his cheek pillowed on his hand. She slid off the bed, settling among the blankets and pillows, and curled up next to him. Mark slept better when he was with her. He'd said so, and she believed it. He'd been eating better, too, putting on muscle fast, his scars fading, color back in his cheeks. She was glad. She might feel like she was dying inside every day, but that was her problem. She'd handle it. No one owed her help, and in a way she welcomed the pain. It meant Julian wasn't suffering alone, even if he believed he was. And if she could help Mark at all, then that was something. She loved him, the way she should love Julian. Uncle Arthur would have called it philia, friendship love. And though she could never tell Julian about the way she and Mark were helping each other, it was at least something she felt she could do for him, make his brother happier. Even if he'd never know. A knock on the door yanked her out of her reverie. She started up. The room was dim, but she could make out bright red hair. Clary's curious face peering around the door's edge.
Emma, are you awake? Are you on the floor?
Emma peered down at Mark. He was definitely asleep, huddled in blankets, out of Clary's view. She held up two fingers to Clary, who nodded and shut the door. 2 minutes later, Emma was out in the hallway, zipping up a hoodie.
Is there somewhere we can talk? Clary said.
She was still so small, Emma thought. It was sometimes hard to remember that she was in her 20s. Her hair was caught back in braids, making her seem even younger.
On the roof, Emma decided. I'll show you.
She led Clary up the stairs to the ladder and trap door, and then out to the dark expanse of the roof. She hadn't been there herself since the night she'd come up with Mark. It seemed like years ago, though she knew it was only weeks. The day's heat had left the black, shingled roof sticky and hot. But the night was a cool one. Desert nights always were. The temperature dropped like a rock as soon as the sun set, and the breeze off the ocean ruffled Emma's damp hair. She crossed the roof with Clary following to her favorite spot, a clear view of the ocean below. The highway folded into the hill below the Institute, mountains rising behind shadowy peaks. Emma sat down on the roof's edge, knees drawn up, letting the desert air caress her skin, her hair. The moonlight silvered her scars, especially the thick one along the inside of her right forearm. She had gotten it in Idris, when she'd woken up there screaming for her parents, and Julian, knowing what she needed, had put Cortana into her arms. Clary settled herself lightly beside Emma, her head cocked as if she were listening to the breathing roar of the ocean, its soft push-pull.
Well, you've definitely got the New York Institute beat in terms of views. All I can see from the roof there is Brooklyn.
She turned toward Emma. Jem Carstairs and Tessa Gray send their regards.
Are they the ones who told you about Kit? Emma asked.
Jem was a very distant, very old relative of Emma's. Though he looked 25, he was more like 125. Tessa was his wife, a powerful warlock in her own right. They had uncovered the existence of Kit and his father just in time for Johnny Rook to be slaughtered by demons. Clary nodded.
They're off on a mission. They wouldn't even tell me what they were looking for.
I thought they were looking for the Black Volume.
Could be. I know they were headed for the Spiral Labyrinth first. Clary leaned back on her hands.
I know Jem wishes he was around for you. Someone you could talk to.
I told him you could always talk to me, but you haven't called since the night after Malcolm died.
He didn't die. I killed him, Emma interrupted.
She kept having to remind herself that she had killed Malcolm, shoved Cortana through his guts, because it seemed so unlikely. And it hurt, the way brushing up suddenly against barbed wire hurt. A surprising pain out of nowhere. Though he had deserved it, it hurt nonetheless.
I shouldn't feel bad, right? Emma said. He was a terrible person. I had to do it.
Yes and yes, said Clary. But that doesn't always fix things.
She reached out and put her finger under Emma's chin, turning Emma's face toward her.
Look, if anyone's going to understand this, I will. I killed Sebastian, my brother. I put a knife in him.
For a moment, Clary looked much younger than she was. For a moment, she looked Emma's age.
I still think about it, dream about it. There was good in him. Not much, just a tiny bit. But it haunts me. That tiny potential I destroyed.
He was a monster, Emma said, horrified. A murderer. Worse than Valentine. Worse than anyone. You had to kill him. If you hadn't, he would have literally destroyed the world.
I know, Clary lowered her hand. There was never anything like a chance of redemption for Sebastian. But it doesn't stop the dreams, does it?
In my dreams, I still sometimes see the brother I might have had. In some other world.
The one with green eyes.
And you might see the friend you thought you had in Malcolm.
When people die, our dreams of what they could be die with them. Even if ours is the hand that ends them. I thought I would be happy, Emma said. For all these years, all I've wanted was revenge. Revenge against whoever killed my parents. Now I know what happened to them, and I've killed Malcolm. But what I feel is empty. I felt the same way after the Dark War, Clary said. I'd spent so much time running and fighting and desperate, and then things were ordinary. I didn't trust it. We get used to living one way, even if it's a bad way or a hard one. When that's gone, there's a hole to fill. It's in our nature to try to fill it with anxieties and fears. It can take time to fill it with good things instead. For a moment, Emma saw through Clary's expression into the past, remembering the girl who'd chased her into a small room in the guard, refused to leave her alone and grieving, who told her, "Heroes aren't always the ones who win. They're the ones who lose sometimes. But they keep fighting. They keep coming back. They don't give up. That's what makes them heroes." They were words that had carried Emma through some of the worst times of her life. "Clary," she said, "can I ask you something?"
"Sure, anything."
"Nightshade," Emma said. "The vampire, you know?"
Clary looked surprised. "The head vampire of L.A.? The one you guys discovered was using dark magic?"
"It was true, right? He really was using illegal magic."
Clary nodded.
"Yes, of course. Everything in his restaurant was tested. He certainly was. He wouldn't be in prison now if he hadn't been."
She put a hand lightly atop Emma's.
"I know the Clave sucks sometimes," she said.
"But there are a lot of people in it who try to be fair. Anselm really was a bad guy." Emma nodded, wordless. It wasn't Anselm she'd been doubting, after all. It was Julian. Clary's mouth curved into a smile.
"All right. Enough of the boring stuff," she said.
"Tell me something fun. You haven't talked about your love life in ages. Are you still dating that Cameron Ashdown guy?" Emma shook her head.
I'm dating Mark."
"Mark?" Clary looked as if Emma had handed her a two-headed lizard. "Mark Blackthorne?" "No, a different Mark. Yes, Mark Blackthorne." A touch of defensiveness crept into Emma's voice. "Why not?"
I never would have pictured you together."
Clary looked legitimately stunned.
"Well, who did you picture me with? Cameron?"
"No, not him." Clary pulled her legs up to her chest and rested her chin on her knees.
"That's just the thing," she said. I mean, who I pictured you with, it doesn't make any sense."
She met Emma's confused look with a lowering of her eyes.
"I guess it was nothing. If you're happy with Mark, I'm happy for you."
"Clary, what are you not telling me?" There was a long silence. Clary looked out toward the dark water. Finally, she spoke.
"Chase asked me to marry him."
"Oh!"
Emma had already begun opening her arms to hug the other girl when she caught sight of Clary's expression. She froze.
"What's wrong?" "I said no."
"You said no?" Emma dropped her arms.
"But you're here, together. Are you not still?"
Clary rose to her feet. She stood at the roof's edge, looking out toward the sea.
"We're still together," she said. "I told Jace I needed more time to think about it. I'm sure he thinks I'm out of my mind, or, well, I don't know what he thinks."
"Do you?" Emma asked. "Need more time?"
"To decide if I want to marry Jace?"
"No." Clary's voice was tense with an emotion Emma couldn't decipher.
"No. I know the answer. Of course I want to. There's never going to be anyone else for me. That's just how it is."
Something in the matter-of-factness of her voice sent a slight shiver through Emma.
"There's never going to be anyone else for me."
There was a recognition of kinship in that shiver, and a bit of fear, too.
Then why did you say it?
I used to have dreams, Clary said.